It was news to me, Harold Bloom, that a few years ago that you are deeply versed in music in general, well, but the boppers and jazz in particular.
I was a Cornell undergraduate from 1946 or 1947 on. And
good years.
My parents lived, yes, in New York, and I would come down. And actually, the first jazz I ever knew was bebop. I was taken by friends, and then I started to go on my own and started to take ladies with me and so on to places like Minton's and Birdland, and became enthralled by Parker and, to a lesser degree, Gillespie, eventually by Sonny Rollins and Miles Davis, but most of all, and by Mingus, whose wife is now a close personal friend, Sue Graham Mingus. I didn't know her in those days and never got to talk to the great Charlie. But to sit there at Minton's or any of the other places hour after hour and drink a moderate amount and just listen deeply was an extraordinary education, because something amazing was being born. And then I fell madly in love with the music of Bud Powell in particular.
Amen.
There's a wonderful anecdote that I discovered, of all places, on a CD thing. There's a guy, a classical pianist, who had been listening to transcriptions. He had made transcriptions of Errol Garner playing. And he reconstructed it, played very beautifully. And the liner, I forget the guy's name, but we have the record here. The liner notes say that on one occasion, Mary Lou Williams, who, you know, was a close friend of Garner and who was a kind of mother figure for all the Kansas City jazz people, is she still alive? She may be.
Could be.
She'd be quite an age now.
Yeah.
She'd be late 80s.
Yeah.
But in any case, Mary Lou Williams invited her friend, the great Horowitz, to come here, Errol Garner live, at a place in New York. And Horowitz showed up. And, you know, this is the best pianist. And with a hat carefully pulled over his head, because he didn't want people, you know, distracting Garner's playing, and he wanted to listen. And after he'd heard Garner play, and I don't doubt these liner notes, he said to Mary Lou Williams, "I would give anything to have a left hand that Garner has." And I suddenly understood, because it had always mystified me, though I'd never dared to ask Bud Powell why he did this. You didn't, I mean, if you saw it, you knew it. Hmm. But even if you listen carefully to say Un Poco Loco or Glass Enclosures or any of the great Powell pieces, Bud basically is a one-armed pianist.
Yes.
He plays with the right hand and he uses the left hand just to double. He doubles endlessly with the left hand, which produces a very curious and at times very effective kind of music. And I suddenly realized it was anxiety of influence. The great influencer upon him, mind you, on the music, not the man, that the great influencer for him was Errol Garner, as it was for Thelonious, his close friend. Mm-hmm. And indeed, even when Powell was craziest or most under the influence, if they brought Thelonious in, he cheered up, calmed down. They deeply loved one another as brothers. I used to hear Thelonious play also. I didn't know what to make of it. That was very tough to listen to, and still is. When I listen to it, I think that Powell was so overwhelmed by the left hand of Garner that he decided he wouldn't even try that. He would just stick to the right hand, which he knew he could handle, and just use the left for doubling, and it became habitual. That's pure surmise on my part.
That's fascinating. And where does Art Tatum fit into this anxiety?
Oh, Tatum and Garner were the great figures for Monk, for Powell, for any of the young bop pianists.
And Earl Hines, in a way?
Earl Hines, in a way, being the father, as it were, father indeed. But otherwise, I would say 40% Tatum, 40% Garner. Hmm. Maybe 45% Tatum. Since they had more direct experience of him, he would occasionally come and listen to them. I never heard him play live, but he was sitting there while Powell played.
Part of the reason this so intrigues me is that I'm more familiar maybe with the anxiety of influence among jazz players than I am among poets.
That is because the whole jazz tradition from at least Armstrong on features what was called cutting. And cutting is indeed the pure instance of what from the Greeks on, and it was revived by Burckhardt, Jakob Burckhardt, and by Friedrich Nietzsche, the agonistic spirit, the agon or contest, and the cutting contests. The last cutting contest I heard was the rather unequal match between the extremely brave Branford Marsilius and
Sonny
Rollins, yes.
Really?
In which I was very brave at Branford.
Mm.
In fact, of all living masters in jazz now, Rollins is surely the greatest who's still extant.
No question. No question. But before him and Coltrane, there was, and definitively maybe, Lester Young and Coleman Hawkins, in the sense that the world is always, among pianists, among saxophone players, among alto players, there's Hodges and there's Parker.
It's always a competition.
Yeah, what is this
Mr.
about?
Mr. Stevens and Mr. Elliott existed at the same time. Mr. Elliott thought well of Stevens and published him in England by Faber and Faber. Stevens refused to say a word about Elliott in prose, though it enters into the letters occasionally, and it was family tradition, as Holly told me. He didn't like Elliott or his poetry, didn't like the fact that harmonium had been crowded out by the wasteland in 1922. And I first pointed out, and in my huge book on Stevens, that every time you have a character called X in the poetry of Stevens, it is T.S. Eliot as poet. Look at the poem called The Creations of Sound. William Carlos Williams is terribly nervous in his letters, and even more people who knew Williams, like Kenneth Burke, used to tell me this. I never met Williams. That Williams was not only aggravated, as we know, by Eliot, but was really nervous about Hart Crane. Nervous about the bridge, nervous about the whole question of what Crane represented and the sheer power of what Crane could do and the rhetoric of Crane. You would have to go back to Whitman and Dickinson to find that powerful rhetoric in American poetry, or indeed in American literature. Faulkner, I guess. Faulkner, who, by the way, was fascinated by Crane and by T.S. Eliot's early poetry. Faulkner, who began as a poet, very much under the mingled influence of Eliot and Crane.
What was the Harold Bloom bridge, so to speak, between Bud Powell and Hart Crane?
I actually talked to Bud Powell about Hart Crane, gave him a copy of the old black and gold Live Right edition of the collected poems of Hart Crane. He was an extremely articulate, if he was having a good day and going through a good time, and quite brilliant person. He read The Bridge, and he read The Broken Tower at my suggestion, and Repose of Rivers, and The Voyages sequence. And I told him there was a real affinity. I thought that I could not hear Un Poco Loco played by him, whether on the recording with those three wonderful takes or in person, without hearing The Broken Tower. The bells, I say, the bells break down their tower and swing I know not where, because that's what you feel is happening, especially when the now alas late Max, he's just gone, and that extraordinary drum work in the latter part of it, particularly on the final take, the definitive take, you really feel that the bells are breaking down their tower and swinging I know not where. You feel that the mind has reached its limit and is coming apart. Un Poco Loco, indeed, the title is well chosen. It is a highly autobiographical work in a very complex way, Un Poco Loco. And for me, it's one of the summits of jazz.
No question about it. But and it has it's sort of the apex of the cowbell in the jazz literature.
Yes.
But then
it's
I also
cowbell indeed, which is sort of ringing doom
clang,
the Hart Crane sense or the Herman Melville sense of the bell tower in which Crane is recapitulating. There's a story called Bell Tower and the Piazza Tales, which Crane is picking up on in The Broken Tower.
But then again, somebody told me just recently that the reason there were three takes was that Bud Powell was upset with Max Roach and his drumming through the whole thing and walked out of the studio saying, that guy screwed up my recording.
And you can actually hear it on the Blue Note thing because rather grimly you hear Powell muttering, "One more," as if to say, "I don't like that one either." Max is not being restrained enough. And indeed, Max suddenly becomes much more classical and restrained in the third one. The one where he goes wild is the second one.
I would give anything. Sonny Rollins did a wonderful interview with us just a couple months ago, but he said like it was hot news. He said, you know, Kenny Clarke said Bird was jealous of Bud Powell, and he sort of identified with that as if to say, Bud was the center. Bud was the most brilliant and understood the music. But I would give anything to just, what was the flavor of that man like?
When I had conversations with him, he was very tightly restrained. You had the feeling of someone who was balancing himself on a wire, knowing he could plunge over on either side. Cheerful enough, but grim underneath. Very tense. Very beautiful. He had that wonderfully stripped-down face at that point. It got tormented and puffy after that, but it was a rather astonishing profile at that point. It's on one of the Blue Note records. I think the one that is extraordinary, almost Spartan sort of a face. Yes, extraordinary profile. Very literate, though he didn't like to talk in terms of literacy. You know that marvelous recording, Jazz at Massey Hall in Toronto, when the five come together for the first time in years, and there are Parker, Gillespie,
Mingus
at the bass, Max Roach, and Bud all there together.
And playing. Parker playing a plastic horn.
Yes, very strange stuff. Has it been stolen or something, or he left it with some pawnbroker or something, but still producing real music. But there's a marvelous moment of pure agonistic spirit because there had been some question of primacy in inventing modes, as it were, between Gillespie and Parker, who hadn't been on speaking terms for years. And at one point in it, you hear, I'm sure you will remember this, on the recording, Charlie Parker saying, "And now I give you my worthy constituent, Mr. Dizzy Gillespie, singing and playing his inimitable Salt Peanuts." And then you hear Salt Peanuts done in a frantic way by Gillespie. But that was marvelous. My worthy constituent.
No.
I mean, how literate can you be? That was terrific. My worthy constituent.
How do we connect these worlds, Harold, of African-American jazz of the 40s, 50s, 60s, and the world of poetry on which you're definitive?
Hart Crane was very influenced by the Armstrongian jazz that he heard. Faustus and Helen is a jazz poem. Other poems by Crane are jazz poems. He used to go with E.E. Cummings. They were on lovely terms. They got along beautifully together. They went out drinking together. Though Cummings was definitely of the heterosexual persuasion. But they really adored one another. Cummings told me this. They used to go around to various jazz bars in the village and listen to the jazz. Crane dies in 1932. That's just about pre-Ellington, isn't it?
Just barely, yeah. He was uptown in 32.
He was already there.
Yeah.
Well, Crane went to Harlem. I suppose he could have heard Ellington. He spent a lot of time in Harlem, in fact, in various bars. Don't know. But jazz is deeply embedded in what Crane is doing. Indeed, I have a former student who's written a book about this, bringing together jazz and modernist poetry, so-called, what's the kid's name? I supervised his dissertation at NYU. Can't remember the kid's name. And then I blurbed the book. Hmm. I've blurbed so many books, I've lost contract. But he has a good chapter on jazz elements in Crane.
Wallace
Stevens had no interest in jazz. He sort of makes fun of it in Notes to Supreme Fiction and elsewhere, but he just doesn't know what he's doing there. And for him, music was always Brahms, his dark familiar, as he says. Mm. A little less returned for him each year. Brahms, though his dark familiar, walked apart.
A friend of mine, a French guitar player, actually, and a wonderful student of American jazz, asked me the other day, or he was just sort of posing a question in his own head, where did Coltrane come from? As soon as he said it, I thought, that's a Harold Bloom sort of question. Where do the transcendent artists and performers come from?
They have to come from what inspires them. They have to come from what they both absorb and then, as I would say, commit misprision upon, do strong misreadings of. Mature Coltrane is a very strong transvaluation, or to use Hart Crane's beautiful term, transmemberment of song. Mm. There's a transmemberment of song that goes on when you move from Parker to middle and later Coltrane. By the time you reach later Coltrane, you can't really trace Charlie in it anymore. You have to go back. But that's where it starts. Mm. The earliest Coltrane... I've never heard Coltrane live, so I don't know what that was like. But the earliest Coltrane that I've heard on recordings is unmistakably Parker. Mm-hmm. You're back in the world of that great piece, Parker's Mood.
Yes.
But it changes enormously, especially because it gets evangelical religion in it.
Yes.
Very strange. I never know what to do with that in Coltrane.
The Love Supreme sort of ending.
Yeah, I'm not sure I like that, the Love Supreme thing.
But this French guy was asking, where does Coltrane come from? In the same way, he also asked, how in the world can we explain Proust? Where in the world does this come from?
Well, we know where Proust comes from. Proust gives us the clue. It's an extraordinary riff on Flaubert, but done by way of Shakespeare. Hmm. Proust could read English the way I wish I could read French. Hmm. I mean, Proust's English was extraordinary. Hmm. Proust not only read Ruskin and was more influenced by Ruskin than by Flaubert, but translated Ruskin, translated two books by Ruskin, the Bible of Amiens and one other. Proust read Shakespeare, as very few people now can read Shakespeare, and a great deal of the treatment of sexual jealousy, the high comedy of sexual jealousy in Proust, comes out of Shakespeare. So the answer ultimately to the origin of Proust is what frequently happens, I think, in the history of literature. One strong precursor in your own language and one strong precursor out of the language, and you mingle them. There's a kind of fusion of Shakespeare, Ruskin, and Flaubert in Proust, out of which, however, comes something radically new. Look, Joyce comes out of Walter Pater, though with extraordinary transformation, amazing transformation.
Walter Pater said, all art aspires to the condition of music.
Yes.
So take it back to Coltrane and jazz. Where do those great, absolutely sort of, to my mind, unexplainable innovators, including Louis Armstrong...
Armstrong stands apart from the others. Jazz doesn't really exist until Armstrong, because it's in those early Hot 5 and Hot 7 things that you really hear what we call jazz being born. Mm-hmm. It's like Shakespeare being born out of Marlowe or being born out of the tradition of the drama before him. Mm-hmm. Shakespeare is inconceivable without Marlowe, but he transcends Marlowe so quickly that you're sort of left gasping, saying, how could this be? In the same way, Armstrong quite clearly comes out of New Orleans jazz. And of course, also, before Armstrong, you don't have someone who can make the instrument, and of all instruments, a trumpet, sound like a human voice. Mm. And then Armstrong was perhaps as astonishing a singer as he is an instrumentalist on the cornet or the trumpet, Armstrong makes the singing voice into a cornet.
Mm.
So, I mean, no jazz singer since has matched him, and no instrumentalist has matched him.
Right.
So he is the great innovator beyond any question. After that, you can talk about Ellington, or you can talk about this one or that one. And then, of course, you have Parker as the strange genius who disturbs the whole thing and sort of breaks the whole harmonic pattern of it.
Mm. You know, above all, I was just so grateful for it, you know? It is completely indigenous and utterly transcendent.
It's Walt Whitman. Hmm. The two great American contribution to the world's art, in the end, are Walt Whitman, and after him, Armstrong and jazz.
Hmm.
Armstrong, Ellington, Charlie Parker, Bud Powell, Mingus, what you will. If I have to choose between the two, ultimately, I wouldn't. I would say that the genius of this nation at its best is indeed Walt Whitman and Louis Armstrong. Whitman has been even more influential because, after all, he's working in language. And when you work in language, then you work partly in concept. And you indeed can have a poet of democracy, though a very elitist poet of democracy, as I keep pointing out, pragmatically speaking. But Whitman's worldwide influence has been extraordinary.
Mm.
Nothing in American literature, not Poe, that Nudnik. I don't like Poe. But nothing in American literature, not Faulkner, not Emerson, nothing has been as, not Mark Twain, all of whom have gone around the world, but not the way Whitman keeps going around the world.
Harold, you're my teacher, and I'm so grateful for the chance to talk to you.